This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night was Alan Alda's fifth and final episode on ER as Dr. Gabe Lawrence, an innovator in emergency medicine who's forced to retire after he's diagnosed with Alzheimer's. In the climax of last night's episode, as Alda is preparing to leave the hospital at the end of his final day as a doctor, a patient comes into the ER with seizures, and the attending resident, Dr. Carter, can't stop them.
He's seizing again.
He's gonna arrest.
Dr. Lawrence, can you help me?
I don't work here anymore.
Please, I got a guy who's coding. His pH is falling and his potassium is rising. He's having refractory seizures. Please. It's nothing obvious. It's not DKA. It's not sepsis. It's not aspirin. It's not uremia.
He's throwing multifocal PVCs.
Get me 6 of Pavilion.
Pavilion?
Just do it.
What's going on?
Guy with refractory seizures and acidemia. Dr. Lawrence has asked me to give him Pavilion.
Come on, push it, Carter.
I've never tried giving Pavilion for acidemia and seizures.
It's strychnine poison. Give me that. I'll do it.
Worked. How did you know?
Strychnine competitively antagonizes the central inhibition of glycine, which causes hyperexcitation. I had a case like this 20 years ago. A patient tried to commit suicide by eating gopher gall. Once you see strychnine poisoning, you never forget it. Check his pH. I bet you'll see it's coming back up. Dr. Carter, your patient will recover.
Thank you.
Score 1 for the absent-minded professor, huh?
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1997 interview with Alan Alda. He became famous playing a doctor, Hawkeye Pierce, the always wisecracking but deeply moral war surgeon in the TV series MASH. Alda's movies include The Four Seasons, Betsy's Wedding, Whispers in the Dark, and Flirting with Disaster. He co-starred in the Woody Allen films Crimes and Misdemeanors and Everyone Says I Love You, in which he got to sing a Cole Porter song.
Looking at you while troubles are fleeing, I'm admiring the view, 'cause it's you I'm seeing, and the sweet honeydew of well-being settles upon me. What is this light that shines when you enter like a star in the night? And what's to prevent her from destroying my sight if you center all of it on me? Looking at you, I'm filled with the essence of, the quintessence of joy. Looking at you, I hear poets telling of lovely Helen of Troy. Life seems so
That's Alan Alda from the soundtrack of Woody Allen's film Everyone Says I Love You. How did you start working with Woody Allen?
I worked with Woody for the first time, I think, about 30 years ago on a pilot that he wrote, and I had a relatively small part in it. And it was about a troupe of improvising actors, and I had been an improviser. And I think it's one of the things that makes me enjoy working in his films is that I enjoy improvising, and he wants the actors to improvise. And we had after that pilot, we ran into each other every once in a while, but I didn't actually work with him again until Crimes and Misdemeanors, when he just sent me a letter and asked me if I wanted to be in the movie.
I thought it was so clever of him to cast you as, you know, this vain, self-absorbed producer, because you had had this image for so long as, you know, like Mr. Feminist, Mr. Sensitive, and it was such a wonderful turn for you.
You know what's funny about that is that I think the last 6 or 8 movies I've been in, I've played either the bad guy or somebody who does kind of reprehensible things. And everybody always says, boy, this picture is such a departure, you know?
Yeah.
I must have made such an impression the other way that every time, no matter how many times I do the other thing, people are going to think it's a departure.
Well, I know I saw you in Whispers in the Dark, which is another one of those roles. You start off as a very kind of sensitive, fatherly psychotherapist, and by the time the movie's over, you're a lecherous psycho killer.
Yeah, a homicidal maniac.
Yeah, well, actually, that was great, a lot of fun.
It's nice to be able to play yourself for a change.
Right? really. Let me ask you a few questions about MASH. What were your first impressions of the script?
I thought it was an extremely good pilot when they sent me the pilot. I was in the Utah State Prison at the time.
And filming a movie.
Yes. I was trying to work on the image there a little bit. I was shooting a movie for about 3 weeks in the Utah State Prison. And they sent me the script of MASH, and it was the best script I had read while I was in prison, certainly. But it was also the best script of any television show I'd ever seen, I think. Larry Gelbart had written it, and it was really sharp, you know. But I was concerned that what would happen after the show went into production. I didn't know if Larry would be part of it, and I was worried that it would become hijinks at the front, and that the war would just sort of exist as a pretext for silly stories. And in fact, some of the early scripts done by freelance writers who didn't know what the possibilities were and were sure that on television you don't go for anything substantive wrote, in essence, McHale's Navy in Korea, you know, on McHale's Navy on the ground. And it really scared me at that point. By then we had already had an agreement, because before I agreed to do the show, I had a midnight meeting with Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds, who were producing the show, and we all agreed that we wanted to do a show in which the war was seen for what it is, as a, you know, a place where people are badly hurt, and the humor came out of the reaction to that. The humor came out of the crazy pressure everybody was put under.
I guess the thought of things turning out badly, of it not being the script that you wanted, during the Vietnam era was pretty scary. I mean, you know, a war TV series during the Vietnam era that gave a kind of hijinks on the front message probably would have made you particularly uncomfortable.
I think it would have, yeah, it probably would have been even more so then than it would be at any other time. But I always felt strongly about wars.
You were in the military, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in the reserves. I don't know if you'd call that being in the military.
Oh.
They put me in charge of a mess hall at one point, and we had to feed 200 people three meals a day, and I had six guys who sort of stared blankly at the wall and played with the liver. I don't know how we fed those people, but I wouldn't call that being in the military. I had to face the idea of it, which was interesting. I watched myself as I was teaching people. It was one of my jobs to teach people how to kill the greatest number of people with a mortar shell, and I would keep them interested. And I wanted to be a good teacher. As long as they gave me a job, I did the best I could, and I was like getting good at making them learn how to do this. You could have long discussions into the night, especially if you're a sophomore in college, about whether that's a moral thing to do. But the interesting thing about it is I understood just from doing that when you're in a war, it's real. It's the real thing. People are going to get killed or lose their arms and legs. And when we did MASH, I wanted to make sure that at least that understanding that I had came out, that's what we dealt with, and that we didn't gloss over that and make the show about how funny things were in the mess tent.
During the period that you were shooting MASH, you also became a women's rights activist. What had you seen in your own family or among your own friends or in yourself that led you in that direction?
I don't know. Everybody used to ask me that in those days. I never came up with a good answer. Time hasn't made that any better. I don't know why. I think I saw that there was, the argument for changing the way we dealt with one another was a good argument. There was a I certainly didn't want my daughters to grow up. I have three daughters, and I didn't want them to grow up in a world where it was taken for granted that they couldn't be what they wanted to be. And I think I saw that there was, that people listened if a man said that. That was unusual at that time.
Do you think that being a women's rights activist ever got in the way of certain roles you would have liked to have? And what I mean is, because you were so busy being the good guy, that you wouldn't get the role as the bad guy.
I don't know. I really don't know. But I think that part of the answer to that question is in the questions you've asked me today. You asked me about playing parts that are so different, like in the Woody Allen movie in Crimes and Misdemeanors. That was such a departure, you said. And I think that that's in your head that way because you saw me talking on television and interviews as myself. And that sort of that, whatever impression you got of me then when I was campaigning for the Equal Rights Amendment, which, and I haven't spoken politically in about 15 years, mm-hmm. but I must have made some impression in those days because you still, you know, today are asking me that question. And I think that something of what you felt about me when you watched me as me sort of fused with what you thought when you saw me playing a character. And that wasn't just you, of course. That was critics and other people.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's not a good thing. In a perfect world for an actor, the curtain should go up and the actor should come out in character, and that's it. You shouldn't see the actor as himself or herself. You know, unfortunately, whether I wanted to talk about a political issue that meant a great deal to me and that I thought I was being a good citizen talking about, whether I wanted to do that or not, I am still required to go out and appear as myself. And it's very few actors who can get away with not doing that. I think Robert De Niro does hardly any interviews. But, you know, Woody Allen doesn't like to do interviews, but he is now doing interviews. The economics are forcing him into it, I think. And the business is set up so that making the movie is only part of your work. The other part of your work is going out and
promoting it. Yeah.
And when you do that, you can't do it in character. You have to do it as yourself. So the audience gets to see a little bit about where the rabbits are hidden. And that's not so good.
My guest is Alan Alda. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Alan Alda. I want to ask you about your formative years. You grew up in show business. Your father was Robert Alda, who, among other things, originated the role of Skye Masterson in the Broadway production of Guys and Dolls, played George Gershwin in the 1945 film Rhapsody in Blue. What was he doing before the movies when you were a young boy?
Well, when I was born, he was in burlesque, and I spent the first 3 years of my life standing in the wings watching strippers and comics and chorus girls, and it was a bizarre beginning to a life. Most of the questions you asked me today can be answered by that, I think.
What did you make of it as a very young boy watching strippers? Did you have any idea what that was about?
I didn't. I do remember. You know, children are so much more aware than everybody gives them credit for. I remember thinking, because when the chorus girls would take me up to their dressing room, you know, they would take me up and they would comb my hair and talk to me, and I was like a mascot, like a little pet, and then they'd say, "Okay, Allie, we're gonna change our clothes now. Turn your back," and I'd stand with my face pressed against their costumes hanging on the wall, and I'd smell the perfume, and I'd hear them behind me. And I remember thinking, they don't think this means anything to me, you know, but this is really interesting. And it had to have a tremendous impact on me. It was a very unusual beginning to a life. I can't trace the roots of that to my present behavior, but... but I do subscribe to a G-string service. They send me a G-string of the month, and it's very nice.
Do you remember the most impressive striptease act from that period?
No, I have talked. I've interviewed people, strippers and comics from that period, because I was thinking of writing about it. And I heard some really interesting stories. There was a woman who stripped with a snake and another woman who stripped with a bird, trained birds, and the birds would take her clothes off. But the one with the snake was really a weird. And there was another one who stripped with a swan. She did a dance called Lita and the Swan. And she said, well, I got another booking in Philadelphia, me and the duck. they all had to have a gimmick, as they said in the song in the musical Gypsy. And some of them, the gimmick was just that they would go as far as they could go. And usually on closing night, they would be raunchier and more naked than they had been up until then, because if the cops closed them down, they were on the road the next day anyway.
Well, growing up on the burlesque circuit, you must have grown up thinking that one of the most important things you could do is have a good gag.
A good what?
Gag. Good jokes.
Oh. Well, I really had a tremendous education watching the greatest comics that we had at the time. Rags Ragland, Phil Silvers, Red Buttons, all these people were... Hank Henry, he was another great burlesque comic. He was my father's partner, and my father and Hank would write their own sketches. Watching them from the wings, and then later watching Sam Levine when he acted with my father in Guys and Dolls, I would stand in the wings twice a day for 2 years watching them, and I'd especially watch Sam. All of these people were a tremendous education for me. I stood on the side, and watching from the side, you see not only what their performance is, you see where it comes from, because you're only a few feet from them, and you hear the audience reaction, and you see the way they play the audience. They have the same material every day, but they play the audience in a different way, depending on what the audience gives them back. And that interaction gives you a clue into the way their brains work. It was a tremendous education for me, and I think I grew up with that interaction with the audience in my head. So when I would write for MASH, for instance, which we didn't do in front of a live audience, I would know when I wrote the comedic moment, I would know what the audience reaction was. I could hear the reaction. And in most cases, that would be true. I mean, I would then, if I'd see it played in front of a live audience, I'd be happily surprised to see that I had guessed right.
I know when you were 7, you got polio. What were your early symptoms?
It seemed like a bad cold. I was in we were in a movie theater that night, the first night that I got it, and it was a crowded theater. My father worked for Warner Brothers, so we always went to the same theater on Hollywood Boulevard, the Warner's Theater, because he could get in free there. He was on a term contract and making basically nothing a week. And it was a crowded theater, and I was sitting a few rows away from them, and I was blowing my nose, honking all during the show. And on the way home, I was honking in the car, and my mother said, "Was that you? I couldn't watch the movie. Somebody was making so much noise." And we got home, and I threw up and had all these symptoms of the flu. It seemed like the flu. Next day, she recognized the fact that I probably had polio. She had been reading in the newspapers and in magazines about the symptoms, and she saved my life, because she had a doctor there within, you know, by the next morning a doctor was there. And by that time my neck was stiff already. And, you know, your muscles just contract. And and the other woman who saved my life was Elizabeth Kenny, the nurse, although I never met her. She was a nurse in Africa, Sister Kenny, who discovered a cure, a treatment for polio. This was before there was a vaccine. And if you got it, you either died of it or you were paralyzed, until Sister Kenny realized that you could get the muscles that had contracted because of this disease, you could get them to open up again through heat and massage. And it's an interesting story, because she figured that out around the First World War. And for 20 years, doctors told her to keep quiet because she was just a nurse. What did she know? She wouldn't tell them how to cure a disease. And in fact, they were using a treatment that was the exact opposite, and they were hurting people with their treatment. And then finally, she just wouldn't keep quiet. She just kept lecturing and trying to get people to listen. And just about 2 years before I caught the disease, she was invited to come to America, and she lectured all over America. And the doctors who treated me had learned from her, I suppose, how to do her treatments. So my life was saved partly by my mother's being aware by reading the papers, and partly by this woman in Australia who just wouldn't shut up when doctors told her to.
Alan Alda, recorded in 1997. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1997 interview with Alan Alda. Last night was his fifth and final episode playing a doctor on ER. When we left off, we were talking about the heat treatments he received as a child when he had polio. So this heat treatment, I've seen a little bit and read a little bit about it. They would wrap your legs in, I think, very, very hot wool blankets that were boiled in water? Or
they weren't boiled. They were heated in a double boiler, so it was dry heat, so it wouldn't scald you. But
your legs weren't burned by it?
Yeah, it was actually every muscle in my body, I think maybe except my left arm, was affected, so I had to be wrapped. My whole body was wrapped up in these things. Every hour a new hot pack. And they were practically scalding. They were really, it was a very tough thing for my parents to go through, because they had to do this every hour, and they had a 7-year-old kid who's screaming and pounding the bed in pain. You know, and I was trying to cooperate with them. I didn't want them to have to suffer, but I couldn't help it. It was very painful. But it saved my life. I have no residual effects from this. But the only residual effect I have is that the massage was so painful, because they would stretch your muscles, a little bit like taking your thumb and putting it back by your elbow. That's how painful it was. And to this day, I can't take a massage. Everybody says, oh, hey, we can get a massage down here, you know, we're going on vacation. And I say, make an appointment for me at the other end of the island. I don't want to go anywhere near it. Massages to me are torture. I would, you know, if you wanted to get information out of me, you send me to a masseuse. And I'll give names. I'll tell where they all are. You can't stand a massage.
Do you have any sense of what the impact was on you of being out of circulation for, I guess it was about 8 months while you were getting these treatments, and for being really sick? I've really met so many artists who were very sick for an extended period during their childhood.
It sounds like a good straight line, but
right, and they're sicker today.
Yeah, that's right.
The humor today.
I remember standing on my bed and looking out the window at my friends playing without me, and wishing I could play with them. But none of them even visited me. Only one came to visit me. But you have to realize that there was an epidemic on at that time, and even though I was no longer contagious, the parents didn't want to take the chance, and it was like the plague. It was like the time of the plague. You were a pariah. So I functioned like somebody who was an outsider from that time on. There were several things that made me an outsider. One was that. Then my parents had me tutored, because I needed to be tutored that year, but that seemed convenient to keep tutoring me so I could travel with them. So I didn't go to school till about the 7th or 8th grade. So I didn't know how kids worked. I didn't even know what the language was. When my father was in burlesque, the burlesque comics would say, you want to beef about it? Hey, I'm beefing about this. I'm beefing about that. Beefing meant, as far as I knew, it meant arguing. So I get to this school, and this kid gives me a shove, and I complain to him, and he says, you want to beef about it? And I said, I think beef means to argue. And I say, yes, I do want to beef about it. Pow! He gives me a shot in the head. This other guy comes over, he gives me a shot, and the people don't even know me now. They got somebody they can hit. So I didn't know how things worked. I was an outsider there. I was an outsider because I came from burlesque, and the world was divided up into entertainers and civilians. And and I would look at the civilians and think that they came from another planet.
During the time that you had polio, which was obviously, you know, one of your formative years, besides lying in bed, what did you do with your time? Did you read? Was there TV to watch?
No, there was no TV.
No TV.
There was radio, but I don't remember listening to it.
So what did you do? Just lie in pain?
Probably daydreamed. I don't remember that part too well. I was seven then. No, I was I was only in pain once an hour when they would put the hot packs on me.
Mm.
So I don't know what I did. I had a very active fantasy life, and you know,
a lot of burlesque queens in it.
yes, as a matter of fact. Yes, I mean, you know, there's. Wait a minute, I'm having one now. That's okay. This is public radio. Everybody's grown up.
That's right. Just about everyone I've ever met who grew up in the 50s or 60s was in some production or another, high school, junior high school, summer camp of Guys and Dolls. Were you ever in a production of it?
Yeah, I was in a, not in school. I mean, I was after I was out of school that they were doing productions of it. I got when I was a young out-of-work actor, only about 6 or 7 years after I'd stood in the wings watching them do it every day, every week, I got a call that a little theater in Illinois was doing it, and would I come out there, did I know the show and did I know the part? And I said, of course I do. You know, when you're an out-of-work actor, you say yes to everything. Well, I'd only seen it. I hadn't learned it. I didn't know the songs really well, you know, and I didn't know the words. And they had lost their leading man and had to do it in 2 days. I had 2 days to get out there, and my hands were shaking when I got on the plane. And I didn't stop shaking until the plane. I never stopped shaking. I mean, I went on opening night with 2 days rehearsal. I didn't know what I was doing.
Which part was it?
Pardon me?
Which part?
I was playing my father's part.
Sky Masterson.
He's Sky Masterson. And I was out in the opening scene, and I couldn't even afford my own suit. So they loaned me a suit that had been hanging on a rack for 6 months someplace, and I kept my hands in my pockets because they were shaking so hard, and I just started nervousness. I was playing with a piece of lint in my pocket, you know, and I'm out there on stage playing the scene with the mission doll. So I halfway through the scene, I take my hand out of my pocket with the lint in it, and I, you know, I casually look down at the lint, and it's not lint, it's a cockroach.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it was very interesting. The sight of that cockroach brought me back to reality with such a jolt that I lost all my nervousness, and I really looked at the woman I was talking to and really talked to her, and I opened my mouth, and a song came out. Everything was great. I mean, I'm surprised they don't bring a cockroach on with me, you know, every time I go on stage as a result of that.
Wow, what a thought. Now, you were going to go to med school.
Yeah.
Then became, I think, an English major. What was the turning point where you said, well, forget that, it's show business?
Well, I never really wanted to go to medical school. My father wanted me to go. He always wanted me to be a doctor.
And you were, but just on television.
Yeah, and he was finally satisfied with that. But the thing was, I agreed that I would go to a pre-med course in chemistry. But at the time, I was afraid that if I did well in this chemistry course, I'd have to be a doctor, and then I'd have to touch sick people. So it really didn't, it was not in my best interest to do well in the course. And I managed to sort of sleep through the classes, and I got a 10 in the final exam.
10 out of 100?
Yeah, 10 out of 100, yeah. And the professor called me into his office, and he had this kind of stunned look on his face, and he said, "Why are you here?" And I thought that was a better question than I'd seen on any of the tests.
Alan Alda, recorded in 1997. This is Fresh Air.